From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. The U.S. EPA is scaling back current restrictions on coal. The agency called the Obama-era Clean Power Plan overly prescriptive and burdensome. States will now choose how much they want to regulate coal-fired power plants. Coal mining states are happy, environmentalists outraged. We'll look at the implications of the new rules right after the news.
KBCC podcasts are supported by SoCal Gas, offering rebates for solar water heating. It works with a customer's existing natural gas water heater to offer reliable and efficient hot water. Invite the strength of the sun into your home or business. Info at SoCalGas.com/solar.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to be with you today. Students returning to school over the past week and a half. One California district experimenting with no dress code whatsoever. No underwear exposure will be too much. No skirts too short. You get the idea. We'll debate school dress codes later this hour. First, the U.S. EPA is proposing states decide how much they want to regulate coal-fired power plants. It's a reversal of the Obama-era Clean Power Plan designed to move the country off coal. The Trump administration move isn't a surprise, but that hasn't tempered outrage from environmentalists. Governor Jerry Brown just released a statement calling the move a declaration of war against America and all of humanity. It will not stand. Truth and common sense will triumph over Trump's insanity. That's the statement from Governor Brown. On the other hand, coal-producing states are delighted. But given the power industry's move toward natural gas and renewables, how much of a future will coal really have? Joining us is Nick Loris from the Heritage Foundation, energy economist. Mr. Loris, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So how helpful will this be for the coal industry?
Yeah, I think it remains to be seen, honestly. The coal industry has been facing a number of challenges just from market fundamentals in terms of cheap, abundant natural gas and declining costs of renewables that have been aided by subsidies. That said, the Obama-era Clean Power Plan would have prematurely forced even more power plants offline at a faster level for not much climate benefit. So it might give some lifeline to some of these existing plants, and it depends on how the final rule is ultimately constructed, dependent upon if it allows for efficiency upgrades to allowed to become online without triggering a new environmental review process, which is known as new source review. So in that regard, it could allow some of these plants to stay online even longer than they otherwise would have. But in terms of the entire industry, they're facing a number of challenges regardless of this rule.
Well, and for coal-producing states, one could certainly see where they would want to move away from restrictions or not restrict coal power plants at all. But I wonder for other states where coal isn't built into the economy, given the price of natural gas, particularly, do you think it's likely that they're just going to continue on seeking to convert power production sooner rather than later?
Yeah, I do. And you've seen that build out in terms of new natural gas build and even expanded renewables in a lot of states, especially where electricity markets are more competitive, because in some of these states, because you have captive ratepayers, a lot of these power plants and utilities can just comply with the regulations and then build that into the rate base. But where you have more competitive markets, they're looking at alternative forms of energy, whether it's renewables or natural gas. And so I think there's a mixture dependent upon, what state you are, what your electricity market looks like, and also what the state wants to do. A lot of states have put in place renewable electricity standards that mandate a certain percentage of their electricity come from renewables. So there's a whole host of things at the federal and state level that are going on this may have some marginal impact. And again, I think it's the right move from a regulatory fashion because the Obama's Clean Power Plan, I would argue, grossly exceeded the statutory authority of what the EPA is allowed to do under the Clean Air Act. But when it comes to the overall transition of the market and saving coal, that's largely unlikely.
We're talking with Nick Loris of the Heritage Foundation, where he's energy economist, Heritage, a conservative think tank in D.C. Also with us from the Natural Resources Defense Council, senior attorney with NRDC's Climate and Clean Energy Program, Alex Jackson. Mr. Jackson, welcome.
Good to be here.
What do you think the effect of this is going to be? Do you think that a number of states will look at backing off of what the Clean Power Plan required?
Well, I think we heard it from the other guests that if anything, our concern is that this new proposal could make existing fossil plants, which are our second largest contributor to climate change in this country, run even more because the proposal limits the scope of the rule only to on-site improvements, meaning we might just be seeing coal plants run a little bit more efficiently. And that belies not only the law on the Clean Air Act, but the facts of how the power system operates. We know that energy efficiency and renewable energy can provide much more reductions at lower cost and provide the health benefits that I think most Americans expect from the EPA.
When you look at states like California, obviously California is not going to back off of its aggressive efforts to move toward renewables and reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Are there other states that were ramping up to meet this Clean Power Plan requirement and at a point where they're going to be changing that?
There are certainly other states that are well along the clean energy transition. I think the good news here is that the market trends that have coal on the ropes are not going to be at all changing by this proposal in any meaningful way. But I think what's troubling is that, you know, California has been a leader for decades on emission reductions and growing clean energy. But, you know, we need partners, and the Clean Power Plan provided a platform by which to engage with other states to coordinate on some of the difficulties for renewable integration, for example, and it signaled that the U.S. was serious in its commitment to abide by the Paris Climate Accord. So without these sorts of, centerpiece rules on power plants and vehicle standards, which were just proposed to be eviscerated earlier, you know, not that long ago, that leadership void is deeply troubling when we are witnessing the effects of climate change viscerally and painfully in California as the state, you know, continues to burn from these wildfires.
Do you have an estimate of what you think, as practical matter, this will mean for greenhouse gas emissions?
Well, nationwide, we know that the plan called for roughly a 32% reduction from 2005 levels by 2030. And by the end of last year, 13 years ahead of schedule, emissions were already down 28% in the U.S. power sector. So I think the numbers to us show that what we need is a stronger plan, not a do-nothing replacement.
Okay. But in terms of so you said it's already dropped 28%. Will this just erode what would have been a greater drop, or is it actually – are we going to see greenhouse gas emissions rise?
Well, that remains to be seen, and let's remember this is just a proposed rule. We don't expect this will survive judicial review, and we will certainly be there to help make the case as to why it does not. But I think the concern is that it erodes some of the certainty, it erodes some of the motivation for some states that have not as yet invested in their clean energy opportunity to proceed. And as noted at the top, it might actually provide a perverse incentive to, you know, make existing fossil plants run more efficiently, which is exactly the opposite of what we need to be doing.
Nick Loris of the Heritage Foundation, how vulnerable legally do you think this proposed EPA regulation is?
Yeah, I think it's certainly going to face legal challenges, and it remains to be seen whether it will hold up. Obviously, because the endangerment finding that states that CO2 is a pollutant and that obligates the EPA to act and regulate CO2 emissions and other greenhouse gas emissions, the EPA has to do something unless the EPA decides to revisit the endangerment finding, which also remains to be seen. But it's important to remember that, you know, the Obama era rule faced a lot of legal challenges, and it was the Supreme Court that granted a stay and halted the implementation of that rule in 2016. So, you know, I think one way or another, we're going to be in for a long court battle.
So you said the Supreme Court stayed the Clean Power Plan, or are you talking about another provision?
Clean Power Plan, that's correct, yes.
So it was not going into effect anyway?
That's correct. The Clean Power Plan never went into effect. The states were, in some senses, gearing up for it, but at the same time, it never went into effect because there was a number of energy companies and states who filed challenges to the Clean Power Plan, arguing that it was constitutionally objectionable because of the way that the Clean Power Plan was structured. And allowed for this, what's known as outside the fence compliance with the regulation, to have more renewables meet the state-specific standards, which people argued, again, was outside of what the EPA would be allowed to do. And so, therefore, the Supreme Court in February of 2016 stayed the implementation of the Clean Power Plan, and then Justice Scalia passed away, and it's kind of been in this holding pattern, and then the election obviously changed what was going to happen with CPP.
So Alex Jackson of NRDC, as a practical matter, even if this proposal is implemented, would it change anything?
Well, I think that's part of the irony, right, is that there's this been so-called war on coal from our regulatory agencies, when in fact the Clean Power Plan hasn't been in effect, and it's been just the clean energy winning on the merits in the marketplace that has been driving these emission reductions. So we do expect that to continue, but I think the concern is just the signals from a leadership standpoint that these actions take, and just the certainty that we need and the more ambition that we need. We know the original Clean Power Plan, if anything, we're seeing was too conservative, and with emissions, you know, ticking up worldwide, and with the importance of the United States as a leader in this global effort, this is exactly the wrong sort of message that we need to be sending at this time.
With the 28% decline in emissions that you talked about earlier, Mr. Jackson, has that largely been achieved through state mandates, or how is that, or has that been just moving to natural gas? What's caused that?
A mix of factors, but certainly renewable portfolio standards, energy efficiency standards in states like California have, you know, helped move the market and bring down the cost of these technologies to where now they are often cheaper than, you know, new fossil fuel plants and even increasingly running existing fossil plants. But, the shale revolution and the growth of natural gas was also part of that. So it's been state leadership. It's been some federal policy, you know, tax incentives. But I think that the takeaway here, again, is that while, you know, we had made some progress, and certainly the reductions we've seen are heartening and reversing longstanding trends in the opposite direction in this country, it is well short of the safe climate scenario that we desperately need to get on track for.
We're talking with the NRDC's Alex Jackson, senior attorney with the environmental organization Nick Loris, energy economist for the conservative think tank the Heritage Foundation in D.C. We're talking about the formal proposal issued today by the U.S. EPA allowing states to have a full latitude on regulating coal-fired power plants here in California. It's not going to change anything as the state moves ever more toward renewables. In fact, Governor Brown coming out and criticizing it in about as strong a statement as I can recall him making, calling this move by the Trump administration a declaration of war against America and all of humanity. It will not stand. Truth and common sense will triumph over Trump's insanity. That the statement released by Governor Jerry Brown today. So we'll see what comes out of this. Nick Loris, how long is the comment process here before potential implementation?
Yeah, it's going to be a while. This kicks off a 60-day comment period. You know, we'll probably not see implementation of this rule for a while, again, not just because of the comment period, but because of the legal challenges to this new rule, too. So not only will it go through a lengthy comment period and finalization of the rule, but it also may face the same long type of implementation that the Clean Power Plan did under the Obama regime.
All right, gentlemen, thank you very much. Nick Loris of Heritage, Alex Jackson of NRDC. You can share your comments on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org, where Joaquin in South L.A. writes, as we saw with the mercury rule invalidated by SCOTUS, by the time the rule was overturned, most plants had already just started to invest in compliance. Even if Trump changes coal regulations, utilities have already changed their long-term capital investment plans. You can share your comments on the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Coming up, a bill in Sacramento which would cap the sentencing enhancements which keep people in prison for longer periods than just what the underlying sentence calls for. We'll be back to debate it in 1 minute. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. You know those school dress codes that, you know, pants can't be so baggy, underwear is showing, or that, you know, shorts can't be too short or skirts too high. Well, a school district in California has decided enough of the dress code. We're going to jettison it, see what happens. As we start the school year, we'll talk about the state of the dress code, that coming up later this hour. But first, the state legislature considering a bill that would cut the prison sentences for a whole range of offenders. It would set a maximum for the number of years someone could be sentenced under enhancements. Now, the most commonly used enhancements to sentencing are for prior imprisonment for a felony, gang-related offenses, great bodily injury from a crime, or the use of a firearm in committing a violent crime. SB 1279 proposes that the cumulative enhancements can at most double a sentence. So in other words, you put all the enhancements together, you can't sentence someone to anything that's more than what's the amount of the underlying offense, what the person would just get for the underlying crime. That could go as far as being doubled with enhancements, and that's all. So what are the reasons for the proposal of the change? With us, Don Spector, Executive Director of the Prison Law Office, non-profit public interest law firm. Mr. Spector, good to have you with us again.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here again.
So share with us how this would work. Do you have any practical examples of how this would affect sentencing?
Well, I don't have any specific examples, but the legislature did do an analysis of the bill, and they found that if 20 individuals are sentenced to, as you said, double the underlying, what they call the base term, and are not eligible for relief under, you know, other laws, then for every year of avoided incarceration, the state would save $1.6 million. And so I think this is a very modest proposal that reinstates something that had been in effect a long time ago from, I believe, 1976 to 1977, which really just makes sure that the sentence that's imposed is somewhat proportional to the underlying offense which caused the person to be incarcerated in the first place.
One thing that was unclear to me is, given the exceptions in this bill and how they seem to correspond with the largest, most commonly used enhancements in sentencing, I'm wondering how big a change it would be. So the exception would continue gang enhancements. Those could still total more than the amount of the underlying conviction. Kidnapping, aggravated sexual assault of a child, infliction an injury resulting in loss of a pregnancy, and prior convictions for serious or violent felonies. That leaves a few of the enhancement categories most oftenly used, but it would seem like most would continue.
It seems like there are quite a few exceptions, which are a nod to public safety. But there, I think it does leave a number of enhancements subject to this bill, such as use of a firearm, great bodily injury that doesn't involve termination of pregnancy, the use of certain prior offenses to enhance the sentence. So I am not capable of figuring out, and apparently the legislative analyst isn't either, of exactly how many people this would apply to, but my sense is that it would have a fairly significant impact, if not, you know, a completely revolutionary impact.
Don Spector of the Prison Law Office with us. Also with us, District Attorney from Amador County, the past president of the California DA's Association, which is opposed to this bill, Todd Reby. Mr. Reby, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
What are your concerns about capping the length of sentences under enhancements?
Well, there are many. Just earlier, when you had asked Ms. Spector whether or not he had any examples, I do have an example. You're probably aware of the ghost ship case in Alameda County in Oakland, where 36 people died in that fire, and there are 36 counts of involuntary manslaughter. Under current law, the maximum exposure that the two defendants face in that case is 39 years. 4 years for the aggravated term for the involuntary manslaughter, plus one-third the midterm for the remaining 35 counts for a total of 39 years. Under SB 1279, the maximum exposure would be 8 years. And many of those victims would have no there would be no criminal accountability for their deaths. That's
so,
the difference.
And I read about the ghost ship example, and I didn't quite follow it, so maybe you can explain. So in this case, the enhancements would be linked to the number of fatalities?
Yes. In that case, it would be one-third, under consecutive sentencing law, you're limited to one-third the midterm for the other offenses outside of the aggravated sentence. So the first sentence would be one count of involuntary manslaughter, aggravated term, 4 years, and then one-third of the midterm, which is 1 year for each additional offense.
So there is no ability in a case like this to sentence differentially based on the number of victims.
Yes. And I'll give you another example. Often we'll have cases where there's multiple child molests. And while SB 1279 does say that in case where it's aggravated child molestation, which means forcible, in cases where it's not forcible but no less traumatic to the child victim, no matter how many victims there are, you're going to be limited to twice the base term. So the same analogy I just gave for the ghost ship, you could say that that's a child molest case, and you'd be limited to twice the base term, which in that case would be 16 years, no matter how many victims there were. So there's no accountability at a certain point for the crime that you committed. And we've been taught as prosecutors from day one that there needs to be that the sentence needs to be reasonably related to the offender and to the offense. This is not reasonably related to the offense.
So it sounds like your point is that these enhancements are able to be used by prosecutors, juries, and judges as a way of differentiating crimes that are similar but affect many more people. So someone who affects many more people is going to get a much longer sentence than someone with the impact might affect one or two people.
And how they commit that crime. You know, for instance, if you create great bodily injury, things of that nature. I mean, it takes away our ability to punish for more egregious circumstances of commission of the same crime. And if I can state another thing, one of our other concerns with this is that this seems to be driven by the prison overcrowding. In fact, the bill itself states as much. And that would appear to violate Marcy's law, the truth in sentencing provisions, which says that sentences are to be imposed individually and shall not be substantially diminished by early release policies intended to alleviate overcrowding in custodial facilities. And it seems that's exactly what SB 1279 is all about.
So do you think if it's passed and signed, there'd likely be a legal challenge to it on that basis?
I think so. You know, particularly given the language of SB 79, where it says in Section 10, in Section 1, sub A 10, it hearkens to the overcrowding situation. And this is just another one of many policies that have, and laws that have been enacted since 2011 that have been designed to alleviate the prison overcrowding.
Rick in Long Beach called to ask, the example of the ghost ship tragedy, would this lead prosecutors then to charge each of the deaths as individual crimes? Is that a possibility?
Well, I think they've already charged them as individual crimes.
So that you would prosecute each one separately as a death, so that then you don't get into enhancement. Yeah. It would be an underlying conviction on each death.
I'm not sure you can do that.
All right. 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722. Or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Hearing the arguments about SB 1279, what do you think of this bill, which proposes curbing, in many cases, the maximum sentencing that comes from enhancements, so that the enhancements can't total more than the underlying sentence for the crime itself. So the underlying sentence could go as far as being doubled, but it couldn't be any more than that once you aggregate all the various enhancements. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Don Spector of the Prison Law Office, what do you think about the ghost ship example?
Well, I think it's a perfect example, which is the fact that as I understand the ghost ship issue or incident, you have two individuals who are being charged with involuntary manslaughter, which means that they didn't intend to kill 35 people. They even under the prosecutor just said, they are going to serve 8 years of their life in prison for this crime if they're convicted. And that seems to me to be a reasonable punishment for something which had a horrible consequence, but there was no intention to harm anybody. And so it's the policies such as these where the penalty would be aggravated, five times the base term, or more, and that's what leads to excessive sentences, which is what we have in this state, and it leads to the great prison overcrowding problem that we have in this state. And the federal judges have already, based on the lawsuit that we brought several years ago, capped the prison population because we were literally too overcrowded, so it has been ruled unconstitutional, and that has been a result of the charging practices of district attorneys all over the state, which result in excessive sentences and keeping people in prison for too long.
What?
And you don't ever see, when we know from the science that long prison sentences don't keep the public safe. They don't have, and especially in this case where you have people without serious criminal records, if they spend 8 years in prison, they're not going to do the same kind of crime again. So there's no threat to public safety for letting them out in 8 years.
And that, of course, a very important consideration. But, you know, another part of the issue is the survivors or victims and their feeling about whether someone is out or not and whether that fits the crime, not just whether the person would reoffend or whether it has a deterrent effect. Gentlemen, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Don Spector of the Prison Law Office, Todd Reby, past president president of the California DA's Association. He's district attorney for Amador County in Northern California. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, we'll talk about student dress codes. One California district says, we're not going to bother having one. We're not going to enforce it. Students can wear whatever they want. I'd like to hear what you have to say about that. Back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Always an honor to have you with us, whether you're listening at 89.3, streaming at kpcc.org, or on the ever-popular KPCC app that allows you to take us in your pocket wherever you go. Coming up in this segment, dress codes and whether their time is past. Alameda School District in the Bay Area is going so far as an experimental dress code policy in which they're going to allow the wearing of, you know, virtually anything a student would likely wear. Now, they still have to cover specific body parts like nipples, genitals, buttocks. However, aside from that, they're pretty much fair game. You could even wear pajamas to school if a student was so inclined to do so. This goes contrary to a number of districts across the state that have policies that don't allow for exposed underwear, for example, that have lengths of shorts or skirts that are mandated. So my question for you is, do you think that this is the right move? Should schools get out of enforcing specific dress codes unless it would perhaps reach the level of indecent exposure that everybody would be subject to? 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. San Francisco Chronicle education reporter Jill Tucker has been writing about Alameda and its experimental policy. Jill, thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Do you know what's driving the experiment in Alameda?
Yeah, the pilot program actually came out of some middle school students in this little island town next to Oakland, where they thought that the dress policy was, the previous dress policy was unfair, and that it targeted mostly young girls because it was looking at hem lengths and, you know, the width of tank tops and things that would mostly apply to girls. And they were finding that girls were the ones being called out. So a group of students basically started challenging this, brought it to the school district, and the school district said, you know what, you're right. They adopted this pilot program where it's the dress policy for this school year that just started yesterday, and they are going to be looking at it again in the spring, see how it went, get some feedback from parents and students, and then go from there.
Are there other school districts in the state, to your knowledge, that have tried a similar experiment?
Well, I think a lot of school districts now are taking a look at this because they're realizing, you know, maybe after the Me Too movement and looking at, how disproportionate these dress policies are in terms of girls being pulled out of class or embarrassed in class or even getting suspended, and taking a look at what the impact is on the educational process. But we do here in the Bay Area and across the state still have dress policies that really are very specific about hemlines and widths of straps and various types of things. The students in Alameda, actually, they were pretty amazing because what they did was they challenged the dress policy by taking a look at clothing available in local stores, like an Old Navy, for example, and basically bringing to the district that 40% of the clothes for females wouldn't pass muster in Alameda with the former dress policy. And I think a lot of schools are looking at the same thing now. They're taking a look at what, you know, the clothing that is popular out there, including rips and jeans, and yet you'll find many, many, many dress policies that ban any holes in pants or jeans.
We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page. I'd be particularly interested in what parts of school dress codes you think are off base, that this shouldn't be there, or ones you think should stay in effect. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org.
one of the justifications that has been offered historically for the dress codes is so students are not a distraction to each other. The idea being that it may be difficult for students to concentrate on what they're supposed to do if they're busy looking at their peers. Jill Tucker, is that, in your sense, one of the things that is an argument against the dress codes, as it puts the responsibility on the one who's wearing something versus the other student?
Yeah, very definitely. The Alameda District modeled this policy after one that was created in Oregon, the Portland, the Oregon chapter of the National Organization for Women. And what they were saying up there was that, you know, by saying that girls can't wear halter tops or they can't show their shoulders, you know, those are typically things that girls wear rather than boys to school, that this is, that showing that skin or showing too much of a leg is a distraction, meaning a distraction perhaps to boys. And what they were saying was, you know, if a boy is distracted in math class, you know, that's on them and not on a girl wearing a halter top, that sends a bad message, you know, to these young women that it's their responsibility to not distract males from algebra or calculus.
However, I do understand the Portland School District considering mandating students have piercings and tattoos. That is, I think, part of the... let's talk with Corrine in Monrovia. You're on Air Talk. What do you think about school dress policies?
Well, I'm a former teacher, and I have always felt that they were putting too much pressure on the girls to make boys behave in some way. And it's like if they stop sexualizing the girls' dress wear and just let them wear what they wanted and the boys wore what they wanted, maybe they would get used to seeing girls' skin and it not being such a tremendous distraction for them. And
yeah.
I think we should be giving our young students an opportunity to use good judgment and to make choices that are going to affect them in the rest of their lives. And dressing is an important part of that.
Yeah, Corrine, I was in middle school and high school in the 1970s, and so the girls at the school, you know, pretty much had free rein, at least in Hollywood, where I went to school, and you just get used to it. That just sort of is, you know, I just don't recall it really being an issue, and I don't remember a dress code particularly being enforced at all. Corrine, thanks very much. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Julian in Silver Lake, welcome.
Yes, hi, Larry. I'm calling because I went to private school for most of my life in the Valley. And I remember girls used to get sent home when their skirts were too short, and male and female teachers would make them measure their skirt lengths with their fingertips, so they'd get sent home for too thin of straps. And I just thought that never sat well with me to see my peers being sent home. And I'm sure that was an embarrassing thing to go through. And I just think it's a complete double standard. And it's really not something that, you know, schools should be, you know, just determining how young girls or other people dress.
So you think no dress code, no reason for it?
Well, I think there should be a dress code to some extent. You know, we always used to have dress codes. You can't wear shirts that have alcohol labels or cigarette labels.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those things are important, especially if you're going to school with a lot of younger people around, as I did, K through 12. But, you know, I think that to determine, you know, too short of a skirt length, or that shirt is too thin, or that's, you know, I too much cleavage or something, I think that's inappropriate for a school to be determining.
Julian, appreciate it. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Sylvia in Whittier, what are your thoughts about whether there need to be school dress codes?
I do strongly believe we need dress codes. These are children. They need to be taught when to dress appropriately. If they can't find the proper clothes for school at Old Navy, they can shop somewhere else. If they enter into a profession where they do have dress codes such as suits and, you know, modest clothing for women, those professionals find in the places. So they need to learn where to shop. I think it's not good actually for our whole society, because the young people dress very provocatively. And you'll notice on television, even the women, even a weather girl will dress provocatively, and it's to draw the attention of the men that are watching. And that's not appropriate.
My wife always comments on how sometimes they look like they're ready to go out clubbing instead of being on television. Sylvia, I appreciate it. Thanks very much. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. So she sees this as a matter of professionalizing presentation, not too young to start that in school. What do you think? 866-893-KPECC. We'll take more of your calls about whether school dress codes still serve an important purpose or not, back in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Such pleasure to have you with us. Jill Tucker, San Francisco Chronicle education reporter, also doubling up on the fashion side of things by reporting on the city of Alameda, its school district's experiment with no dress code. Essentially, what they've adopted is you can't be indecent, so probably things that would get you stopped by police if you're out in the world would be banned. But other than that, pretty much fair game for you to wear to school. What do you think about that? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Paul in Culver City, welcome. What do you think?
I think it's the worst idea you can possibly have at this time. And like you just said, it's fair game. You know what? Our educational system is not about games. And we've got so many distractions as it is. We're trying to get money in the schools. We're trying to keep guns out of the schools. We're trying to keep cell phones out of the schools. And all these things are taking away from the actual practical application of education. And this is one more distraction that we don't need. And like the other caller said, there's a degree of orientation and implementation of dressing appropriately, whether it's for school, whether it's for church, whether it's for a business, an office, and it all starts in the home, and it all starts early on in school. I had applicants come in. I've had interns come in, and I'm thinking, you come into a work environment, and you got sandals, board shorts, and a tank top. But if they haven't been taught early on, they'll never learn.
All right, Paul, I appreciate it. So I think schools have a role in that, part of the educational process to dress more appropriately for the environment. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Eugene in the city of Orange says, I'm a former high school teacher, and one of the problems with dress codes is that it gives boys the idea that if girls are wearing something deemed sexual, it perpetuates the, quote, girls are asking for it concept that occurs with assault or harassment. That's Eugene in the city of Orange. Sam in Irvine says, I work in the gaming industry, and culturally we're pushing away from putting the responsibility on women. Teaching kids to find their own identity through clothes is a good thing. I think this is going in the right direction. And Bill in Covina suggests that students themselves decide what their dress code is going to be, that students actually choose that, vote on it, and decide what, if any, dress code they have. Bill, thank you for that. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. And Jill Tucker, again, you said this was middle school students who had pushed for this?
Yes, it was middle school students at Lincoln Middle School who basically, you know, many of these students had been personally affected by it. One school that we profiled in the story, she walked into the office for some reason. She had a cardigan. She had a scoop neck tank top, so her shoulders were covered. Her jeans weren't ripped. They were full length. And she was told that her dress was inappropriate. And she said at the time she was 12, had no idea even what was wrong with her outfit, but figured that maybe her top was too low, even though she didn't have a cleavage to show, and she felt humiliated, and so the students really took this up and basically said, you know, students are missing class because, you know, they're wearing soccer shorts, you know, to school, and they're missing valuable class time. So, you know, the district agreed with them that it was more important for these kids to be in class rather than for somebody to be measuring their straps or their hem length in the office.
Jenny, in Yorba Linda, I understand you're a middle school teacher, so you have an on-the-ground take we want to hear. Go right ahead.
I do. I've seen young girls in our schools being sexualized by the adults that are there. The kids, honestly, don't really pay attention to what each other are wearing. It's the adults that are the ones that are getting all up in arms about this. And personally, I, as a teacher, I care about what's in their heads and what's coming out of their mouths, not what's on their backs.
And do you think that there is any type of clothing that should be banned from schools? Or do you think this is how kids express themselves and there's no point in having a code?
Well, to me, I look at what the Supreme Court says, and that is they can't take away the rights of others. So if a student is wearing hate speech, something like that,
mm-hmm.
making that an issue because it makes other students not able to be comfortable in this educational situation they're entitled to. Other than that, I don't really care what they wear. I care about what they learn and what they say.
At your school, has this been an issue?
It has been an issue. Teachers have made it an issue. We've had different administrators through our school. We've had some administrators that literally stood at the gate and inspected each girl as they walked in. The teachers had quite an issue with that. We made that known. We have an administrator now that is more lax in the situation, and now it's not much of an issue. The kids are wearing the same thing. There's really nothing wrong with what they're wearing.
Jenny, appreciate the call. Middle school teacher, Yorba Linda, joining us on Air Talk. Nicole in Claremont, welcome. What do you think?
I think that we're missing a piece here, too, which is about these dress codes that are really strict encourage body shaming, particularly on Black and Latina girls who might develop faster at a different rate. When I was in school, I was literally reprimanded for wearing the same exact thing as girls with a smaller chest just because of what my body shape was. And then that did impact my ability to learn. And so I think that there's an issue of the way that this impacts girls' feelings about their body and their ability to learn when you have these really strict dress codes. So I think it's good that what Alameda is doing.
Why? How did when you were reprimanded for what you were wearing? How'd you respond to that?
I mean, this is middle school, you know, I'm 14 or something years old. They would just make me put on a sweater and I'd be wearing the same shirt underneath as another friend. And that girl would get to walk around with a sleeveless shirt on all day. And I'd have to be in a sweater when it's 90 degrees outside. And when you're 14, there's not much you can do about that if you want to go to class other than just get sent home, right?
Yeah. Nicole, I appreciate it very much. And interesting point you raise about perhaps differences in the physical builds of girls and how, you know, one girl treated differently wearing the same thing. I really appreciate your sharing that. Let's talk with Jenny in Northridge. Jenny, I'm very short on time, but I understand you're also a teacher. So what do you think?
Well, I agree that there should be some kind of dress code, basically because we're doing more than getting content area with these kids. We're preparing them for life. And especially in later years of high school, if we tell them this is okay, you know, so they get embarrassed if they're sent home and whatever, maybe we're preparing them to get that job in the future, you know, because the person that interviews them is not necessarily going to say, I didn't hire you because you came in dressed for the beach.
All right, Jenny, I appreciate it. Thanks for sharing your perspective. Max tweeted at AirTalk, as a former educator, I found it best when the students had uniforms. But if a school doesn't opt for a uniform, we shouldn't put the onus on school staff to enforce strict dress codes. You can share your comments on Twitter at AirTalk, on the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Jill Tucker, San Francisco Chronicle education reporter, thanks so much for talking with us about this very interesting experiment by Alameda Unified School District.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. Dare Talk on KPCC coming up in our second hour. One of the things we're going to take a look at is the challenges dropping your child off at college, the emotions that go both ways. Back in a moment.
KPCC podcasts are supported by SoCal Gas, offering rebates for solar water heating. A solar water heating system doesn't replace your existing natural gas water heater. Instead, it helps by preheating the water with the warmth of the sun to help you use less energy. When you install a system at your home, you'll still have the hot water your family relies on for baths, showers, and laundry. You may save on your SoCal Gas bill and get rebates that may cover nearly half the system's cost. It's the strength of the sun in your home. Learn more at SoCalGas.com/solar.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope your day's going well. Coming up, that time of year when kids are heading off to college. For some, their heads too. For some parents, a sign of relief that they get their home back, but for most, an emotionally challenging parting. Handling the emotions of college separation later this hour. I'm going to go through that in a year when our son heads off to college. But first, the LA Times recently published a story focused on wealthy Californians who'd inherited extremely expensive homes that they were now renting out. The heirs were able to keep their parents' far lower Prop 13 controlled property tax rates while profiting from big money rentals. The Times reporters described this as depriving school districts, cities, and counties of billions of dollars in revenue. Now, the former state assemblyman who authored the bill protecting inherited homes from reassessment and higher property taxes said his intent wasn't to create a rental windfall for the heirs. The idea was to allow those who inherit their parents' homes who couldn't afford the reassessed property taxes to still keep the family home. But my question for you is, should the law allowing a lower property tax basis on inherited homes be restricted to heirs who live in those homes, not rent them out? Or should the Prop 13 property tax limits completely expire upon the death of the homeowner, not able to be transferred along with the property to the heir? Or do you think things should stay just as they are? We're at 866-893-KPECC, and I'd like to hear from you if you've inherited a family home that you chose to rent out. I'd like to hear your thoughts about this and how important it was to be able to keep the property, Proposition 13 property tax basis that you had received along with the house as part of the inheritance. 866-893-KPECC. With me is Democratic State Assembly member David Chu of San Francisco. He represents the eastern half of San Francisco and chairs the Assembly's Housing Committee. Assemblyman Chu, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
What changes are you proposing to this law?
Well, we've just been apprised of the LA Times analysis, and so we're reviewing different options as we speak. But the data we've seen is very telling. At this time in our state, the story of California is of skyrocketing income inequality. And clearly this policy has exacerbated that income inequality, has been symbolic of that, where a lucky few win and everybody else loses. This came about a number of years ago with a ballot measure, Proposition 58, which was on top of Prop 13, which was supposed to allow kids to live in their parents' home. But over the years, we found that it has been an enormous tax break, which has turned an inheritance into windfall rental investment properties. That wasn't the intent. It's costing our state billions of dollars. And given the affordable housing crisis, we need to use our scarce government dollars differently.
Are you concerned that if you make a change and you don't allow the tax break for rental properties that are inherited, that it could lead to a number of those properties coming off the rental market because the heirs would, if they're not going to live in the house, be forced to sell it?
Well, if they're forced to sell it, then other people get to live in them.
Who can afford to buy it?
Well, we know that individuals will be able to buy it as opposed to a handful of kids who are lucky enough to inherit a property from their parents being able to get a rental investment property. This when this policy was put into place, the idea was not that someone could inherit a property, rent it out, turn a massive profit, and see the state of California subsidize a person's real estate career, a person's real estate investment properties. That wasn't the intent. And the initial estimates of what it was going to cost the state were $28 million. Today, this costs the state 50 times that, $1.5 billion a year, monies that should be going to schools, to funding for other critical services, to affordable housing, to help address our homeless crisis, our eviction crisis, rather than providing a windfall for a handful of kids.
Well, one thing that would seem to be an important analysis, and this was not part of the Time story, because they really focused on these examples of, you know, multi-million dollar properties that are bringing in tens of thousands of dollars a month in rent, is to see how much, you know, in the total number of properties inherited that are rented out, where those are distributed, because I would bet the majority of the properties, maybe not in aggregate value, but in number of units, are instead in middle income and even working class neighborhoods. There are probably a fair number of inherited houses in East Los Angeles and South Los Angeles and the Central Valley that are rented out by heirs and money used to help put kids through college and to pay for family expenses and the like. Is it important to you to understand the totality of the effect, or are you just really concerned about the loss of revenue?
Well, clearly we probably need to dig another layer to understand what's really going on. But what the LA Times analysis showed was that over two-thirds of these properties are being used as investment properties. So they're either being rented by short-term tenants on Airbnb or by long-term tenants. But either way, the owner's not living in them, which means that the purpose of the tax break, which was to allow kids to continue to live in their parents' home, is not being met. And if the tax break ends, either the children move back into these homes or they sell them, but we know that they will be used for housing. The idea, though, is not to give billions of dollars of a tax break to a handful of folks. U.S. Supreme Court has looked at this over the years, and if I could just quote Justice Blackmun, who was questioning why these homeowner children receive these tax breaks. And literally, he said in oral argument, they're just a sort of class of nobility in California. They inherit this tax break. It goes on from generation to generation. They're not seniors. Another Supreme Court justice said that this inheritance benefit was one of the most unfair provisions in our California system, quote, establishing a privilege of a medieval character. Two families with equal needs and equal resources treated differently solely because of their heritage. And we need a fair system, particularly with the skyrocketing inequality we have and the housing crisis that we are experiencing.
Hmm. I guess I hear what you're saying. I look at how many properties are owned in working class communities by families who've owned those homes for quite a while and are looking to pass them on to their kids. So I hear the characterization. These are all a bunch of privileged, rich people. But home ownership crosses all different boundaries here. Especially we're talking long-term home ownership. We're not talking to people that are, you know, trading around properties all the time. These are people that have owned properties for a long period of time. So the Prop 13 basis benefit has been established over a longer period of time. But I'd love to hear from listeners. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Joyce in Westwood, quick comment.
Yes, I own, my parents have passed away. They bought their house in 1938. Are you there?
Yeah.
Okay, they bought their house in 1938. My brother, sister, and I inherited it in 1993 when they both passed away. We rented and have rented it since 1993. We rented about $2,000 to $3,000 less per month than the going rate in Westwood because we'd like to do that for a young family. The home has been there in my family since 1938. My sister, myself, we own our own homes, and it's just our way of giving back to the community. We don't, you know, we could get easily another $3,000 a month for rent, but we don't
Yeah, Joyce, I appreciate your call. Of course, there'd be other people who'd have a different perspective of that, have owned the home and could make a lot of money on it. So you couldn't really set the policy based on what you individually do, but appreciate it. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Let me introduce managing partner at the Pasadena law firm Hahn and Hahn. He's also a certified public accountant as well as being an attorney, Carl Swedan. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me today.
So one of the things I was thinking that if there is a bill to change this, would people just find creative ways of working around this? For example, that the family puts it in the name of the heir before they die so that there's no change in listed ownership, or it's a family trust that ends up, as particularly with high-end properties, is the norm. They're typically purchased with trusts. Are those ways that would effectively get around any changes in the law anyway?
That's possible. It'll really depend on how this new change is drafted. The one thing to keep in mind with this current law, the transfer is not just at death. It's also during lifetime. So it's permitted either way. The other thing I'd like to comment, if I may, and that is I tend to agree that a lot of people are getting benefit from this that are middle class, that are immigrants, that have come here and worked very hard, and they've accumulated this by giving up a lot to be able to acquire these properties. And there's a very strong feeling they want to pass this on to their children. They feel that they have done without for many years, and it's very important to them that they're able to pass that on to the next generation and beyond.
All right. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Assemblyman Chu, do you feel pretty confident you are going to introduce a bill that changes this? And if so, do you feel like you have an idea of what the primary aspects of that bill will be?
Well, we've just learned about this analysis, but my staff is reviewing it, and certainly this fall, after this session of our legislature finishes up in August, we will be looking hard at what proposal makes sense. Taking a step back, this tax provision builds on the very negative consequences that Proposition 13 has had on our state. We have seen billions of dollars depriving our schools of funding, of critical funding for our social safety net, that has exacerbated our housing crisis, and it's been very challenging to address that. And this provision that we're talking about was layered on top of Prop 13. And I think anyone who looks at this, I appreciate the comment before from Joyce. Unfortunately, I think most landlords don't take the generous perspective that she does and give breaks. Most charge market rates. And if you look at the LA Times article, when you have properties that are being rented at $15,000 a month, and it's very wealthy individuals who are benefiting from that. If we had $1.5 billion a year to spend in the state of California, would we choose it to subsidize a handful of children to essentially be real estate investors, or would we provide this more broadly to folks that are struggling in our housing crisis or to help pay for kids in the classroom? I think we would all choose the latter, and clearly this needs to be addressed. I would also say you don't even have to live in California to get this tax break. No other state in the country provides this tax break, and I'm very sympathetic to those who want to live in their parents' home and can't afford paying the property taxes that others have to pay, but that's not what we're seeing in the majority of these cases, and I think that is something we need to do.
So are you okay with continuing the Prop 13 lower basis if the heir lives in the inherited house?
I think it's something that we should consider, but the fact of the matter is these are individuals who have received a home. And the homes are likely quite valuable, and they can. While I understand no one likes to pay property taxes, the reality is we're asking them to pay the same property tax as someone who didn't have the benefit of a parent who was able to pass along the inheritance. And And at the same time, we have an entire generation of Californians who are working super hard, trying to enter the housing market, and can't because of this very tax break that's being provided to these individuals who receive this real estate investment. It's an incredible barrier to enter the housing market for millions of other Californian children who...
Carl, do you want to respond to that?
Sure. I think this is one of the few tax breaks that, surprisingly, California affords homeowners in California. Other states that perhaps don't have this benefit don't have any income tax. They have a very low rate on the income taxes if they do. I think this is one of the few breaks that people do have, and I think it's very beneficial for a lot of the population. I think also for with the change in the new federal estate and gift tax rules, this is for Californians the biggest tax that they need to worry about. And to make it even higher, I think would possibly exacerbate some of the issues that the Assemblyman has rightfully, I think, brought up. But I think it is something that is beneficial. As I said, many of my clients are not these handful of very wealthy people. There are many people who in the area, and as Larry, you pointed out, are in areas that are middle-income taxpayers that this would put them effectively out of business. I think the other thing that sometimes I think about in the LA Times article, which was very well done, the word deprived, that I feel I wonder if that's necessarily a good word to use, because I think these are taxpayers. And I always like this quote from a very famous judge, and I believe the Assemblyman would know, that there's nothing sinister in so arranging your affairs as to keep taxes as low as possible. Everybody does it, rich or poor, and there's nothing wrong with it.
All right, we'll continue. We have many more calls that are coming in. Liam Dillon, who co-wrote the piece for the LA Times, the Enterprise piece, said Larry Mantle just said he believed the majority of inherited properties being rented are in middle or working class neighborhood. That's not correct. We found the highest percentage of rentals in... Yeah, I wasn't talking about percentage, Liam. He said, we found the highest percentage of rentals are in prime vacation spots in Sonoma and Santa Cruz. I'm talking about the totality of people that are affected, not the percentages given in certain areas. Because obviously where you got a big profit incentive in resort areas, yeah, you're definitely going to see, because the money's too good for the air to turn down. We'll continue our conversation. We're at 866-893-KPEC. Back in 1 minute. We have a number of calls to take as we look at the Enterprise piece in the Los Angeles Times, which showed for many wealthy property owners in California, they inherited the family home, chose not to live in it, and rented it out instead for huge rentals. A number of oceanfront properties were described, places in resort areas. And the reason that the family members were able to do this was because the Proposition 13 lower tax basis that their parents had accumulated over years of ownership passed down to the kids, who then turn around and rent out the house for a big profit. The question is, should that tax break under California law continue? Should there be a requirement that the heir live in the home if they're going to have the lower property tax rate that the parents had? Or should the inheritability or heritability of that property tax break exist at all? Should it go away once the parents die? We're at 866-893-KPECC. Assemblyman David Chu, who chairs the Assembly's Housing Committee, one of the things I wanted to ask you about is just property taxes generally, because there are a lot of people who believe that property taxes should be higher. They don't like Proposition 13. At the very least, they want to see a split role where commercial properties aren't covered by Prop 13, or they want to see the ability to inherit the break go away. But just looking at property tax revenue in general, is California per capita lower than other states? I mean, I know we have Prop 13, but the values of property are so high here. Doesn't California still take in a lot of money in property taxes?
We do take in some funds from property taxes, but because of Prop 13, and for listeners who are less familiar with it, in the 1970s, Proposition 13 said that there would be a significant cap on property taxes. And so what we've seen over time is property taxes have not kept pace with the values of people's homes. And because of that, funding for schools and for other critical services has dropped dramatically. So, for example, our schools in the 1970s used to be one of the top-funded school systems in America. We were one of the top 10 performing school systems in America. And now, in this decade, we are one of the lowest-funded school system because of our diminished property tax base, and we have one of the worser performing school systems because we have not been able to pay our teachers what they are fairly due. We haven't been able to get resources into the classroom, and this is all a function of the fact that Proposition 13 capped these property taxes. And what we're talking about today was essentially son of Prop 13, Prop 58, which was designed to allow kids to live in their parents' homes, but it wasn't designed to allow them to get these enormous tax breaks. And listening to the trust and estates attorney earlier, he talked about how if we close this tax loophole, we might be putting some of these wealthy individuals out of business. They weren't supposed to be in this business in the first place.
And I don't think he was talking about the wealthier ones. So I think he was talking about middle class, working class.
The idea was, this tax break wasn't supposed to allow them to go into a real estate investment business. The real question is, should the state be subsidizing these real estate investment individuals to the tunes of billions of dollars when we have so many other very intense needs in the classroom when it comes to housing, when it comes to homelessness,
okay,
addiction crisis, et cetera?
Summer in Buena Park, what are your thoughts?
Hi. I find that last comment actually particularly offensive. My grandmother gave me her home when she passed. I'm the only one left. And it's ironic. The reason I have to rent it out is because I have to pay for my schooling. So I went to the University of California, and it's so expensive that anyone that's in their 20s is never going to be able to pay off their student loans, let alone get a job, let alone – and also wages have not gone up the way the prices for housing is. So, of course, we can't buy homes. I find it really upsetting that they think we're an investment company when it's literally just trying to survive. And it's something that our parents worked or grandparents worked exceptionally hard for. And we're not abusing it. We're literally just trying to find a way to be able to make it.
Summer, I appreciate your call. Let me go back to attorney and CPA Carl Swedan. So her alternative, let's say, so if she lost the Proposition 13 benefit upon the death of her grandparents, she's the sole heir, it sounds like. She couldn't afford to keep the house because she couldn't pay the property taxes, so she would be forced to sell the house. Would she have capital gains liability on that, or what would the scenario be like if she was forced to sell it to fund her college education?
It's hard to tell with her situation. If the grandparent had died and her parents were deceased, both of them, then if she turned around and had to sell the house, she probably wouldn't have any capital gains. She could sell it, but then you have to compare what she could do with that money versus having it rented out and being able to receive the income over time and the appreciation in the home as well. So it seems to me it would be a difficult position to put this individual in, having to sell. That was the real reason why Prop 13 was passed in the 1970s. People were forced to sell their homes because they couldn't afford the higher property tax bills. And so it would hit someone like her, and it would be happening all over again. If there are to be tweaks to Prop 13, that's certainly possible. It's going to be it's a policy decision, and it's going to be very difficult because the people of California in the past have been really in favor of this proposition.
Assemblyman David Chu, would there be a potential other way of going about this to where there is a cap on the amount of rental income that an individual could get from an inherited property and still qualify for Proposition 13 lower tax basis? Is that another way to keep the super wealthy people running it as a business versus Summer in Buena Park?
Listen, we're going to look at all policy options of what's possible, and I'm very sympathetic to the perspective that Summer had raised. You know, unfortunately, part of the reason why higher education is so expensive is because we have lost billions of dollars that should have come to help pay for schools during that exact same time period that Proposition 13 deprived the state of that funding. So it is all a vicious cycle. And certainly we want to be able to support folks who are trying to make it. And I'm sympathetic to the perspective that Summer had laid out, but there are millions of Californians who unfortunately don't have a parent or grandparent who is able to gift them a home. And those are folks who are struggling who can't take advantage of this $1.5 billion tax break every year. And that's why we're looking at whether this is the best and highest use of very scarce tax resources.
We're talking with Assemblymember David Chu. He represents the eastern half of San Francisco, and he chairs the Assembly's Housing Committee, which is looking at the reporting, the Los Angeles Times story of a few days ago, which shows how for many wealthy people who inherit property from their families, instead of living in it, they rent it out while keeping the lower Proposition 13 tax basis. I understand that you need to go, Assemblyman. I want to thank you very much for joining us and talking about it. Any timeline for when you think you might develop a bill out of this?
The next time to introduce new bills would be at the beginning of next year, and we'll certainly be having conversations in the fall, and happy to receive any feedback, public or private, about different ideas that we have in this area.
Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you.
David Chu, California Assembly Member. We'll continue with your calls at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Lenore in Gardena, welcome. Hi, Lenore. Turn down your radio, please. I'll come back to you if you're ready. Sally in Studio City, you're on Air Talk.
Hi, Larry. I just wanted to say I know there are all kinds of mixed situations with this, but I benefited from Prop 13 since the 70s. I owned my own home at the time. I kept it and rented it and bought a different home. I eventually kept that one and rented and bought a different home. So I have three houses that benefit from Proposition 13. I'm so grateful. It's helped me tremendously. But when I leave those properties to my daughter and or my grandchildren, I have felt guilty all these years about benefiting when other people, that was, you know, 50 years ago almost now that law was in place. I think in many ways we've suffered from Prop 13 in California, and I think it's maybe time to fix it.
All right, Sally, 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Richard, in Mount Washington, what's your opinion about this law?
I don't like the politicians and their arrogance in figuring that the state should gobble up every single dollar that they can from the citizens. I bought my house in the early 70s for $21,000. I've paid property taxes over $2,000 every single one of those years. When I die, I'm an old man, I want to pass it on to my daughter. And it's her property, and what she does with it is nobody's business.
All right. So, I mean, what we're hearing, Richard, I appreciate your call, is a real philosophical difference here between people who believe that passing down property, that there is an important value in that, that essentially government should not be an impediment to that, and that the benefit that the homeowner gets should be able to accrue to the heir, and that there's value in that, and others who feel as though it's sort of like hitting the lottery, that the heir really didn't have anything to do with that, the heir shouldn't get the benefit, and what's interesting is that you've really got – that's a much deeper implication, because we sort of societally have said there is a value in passing down property. Carl Swedan, I wonder – I mean, do you think that public sentiment about that is changing?
I don't know. That's a good question. I think the polls that have been taken, there may be some acceptance of some tweaks, but I think as a – overall matter, I think it would be very painful for people, and I think there's still a lot of support. The one thing I also wanted to mention is this parent-child exemption is elective. It's not mandatory. So for the individual who said they felt guilty, her heirs don't have to necessarily take the benefit. They can inherit the property or take the property and not take that benefit, and she could try to convince them not to. So it's not a mandate that it be taken. You do have to file a form. You have to affirmatively want to take the benefit. And so people have a choice.
All right. We'll continue our conversation. We're taking your calls at 866-893-KPCC. We also have reports from multiple news outlets on a breaking story on the East Coast. We'll have that for you right after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Good to have you with us on Air Talk, Larry Mantle, with managing partner at the law firm Hahn & Hahn in Pasadena. Also, certified public accountant Carl Swedan with us. And we're taking your calls about an LA Times Enterprise piece which laid out examples of very wealthy Californians inheriting the family home and paying low property taxes on it because they also inherited the Prop 13 tax break from their parents, then turning around and renting out those homes for tens of thousands of dollars a month, and the tax basis not being reset. We're getting your thoughts on that, what you think about it. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Multiple news outlets, including the Associated Press, report that Donald Trump's ex-attorney Michael Cohen will be in New York federal court very shortly, and that he will be pleading guilty in a plea deal involving bank fraud, campaign finance, tax violations. So we expect to get the details on that very shortly. Once again, multiple news outlets, including the Associated Press, reporting that Michael Cohen has reached a plea agreement with federal authorities and that that is going to be made public in a New York City courtroom very shortly. Let's continue with listener calls. Let's talk with Meg in West L.A. You're on Air Talk. What do you think, Meg?
Well, one point that I don't believe has been made yet, or that I haven't heard be made, is that for all practical purposes, people don't pay inheritance tax, so especially people of modest means. So anybody who inherits a home in California doesn't pay property. I mean, doesn't pay inheritance tax. Previously, people did pay. And so this break on property tax is just kind of like, frosting on a cake that's already very sweet. The person who called and, you know, said that she had all these expenses and that she was renting the house to cover those expenses could have easily sold the house. And, you know, if her grandmother's estate wasn't over $5 million or something, she wouldn't have paid estate taxes.
All right. I appreciate the call, Meg. Thanks very much. Carl?
That's a good point. And I think I brought it up earlier that for a lot of people now, they do not pay an estate or a gift tax because of the higher exemption amounts. And so for many people, this is the tax that's going to hit them. I think it's a philosophical issue, which is these dollars, who do they belong to? And that one is that's why you have propositions and that's why you have legislation and sometimes you let the electorate try to vote and make a decision on that. And that's what Prop 13 was. And if you change it, then if people want to do that, they can.
All right. I appreciate the call, Mick. Thank you very much. Lenore in Gardena, you're on Air Talk.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So my brother and I inherited a house in East L.A., and I was so attached to my father, and I know he fixed his house just for us to live in. So, but we can't live in there yet because we're still working, and it's far away from us. So our option was to rent it out, and we barely can make the improvement payments because we spent a lot of money on improving it because it is an old house. And if we were taxed, I don't know what we do, but we don't want to sell it because of, I guess, sentimental reasons. And my father has, I mean, my brother has 5 kids that he needs to go to college to, that kind of a thing. So we really never want to sell it.
Yeah, but if you were going to have to pay the current the property taxes based on current market value, if it was reassessed at the time of inheritance, do you think you would have been able to keep the house, or you just would have sold it and split the proceeds with your brother?
Well, to tell you the truth, I never wanted to sell the house. So.
But what do you think you would have done?
I don't really know, because it would have just torn my heart apart if I had to sell my father's house at the time. And I was so emotional about it, I just let my husband take care of it. So I wasn't posed with that question.
Yeah. Lenore, I appreciate your call. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Renee in Duarte, welcome. You're on AirTalk.
Hi, Larry. Yeah, I just have a few comments, but one of them is everyone's talking about these school districts not getting the current tax rates and they're being robbed. And really, that's ridiculous, because these inheritors are paying taxes on the current rental value they receive. And the thing is, as a state collectively, between the taxes for home and for sales and for income, we have some of the highest taxes in the country. So if they want to redirect the taxes that these inheritors are paying on the rental income they receive to the school districts, that's a way to reroute the money that wouldn't have gone into the income tax pile to begin with, but to still preserve the dignity of this inheritance over time. And this argument about, like, resort places and this and that being up for rental – well, homeowners that are going to live in homes aren't going to go buy in a resort anyway. So you're not opening up a home for a family to live in. You're opening up another commercial rental property. And our housing crisis in California is not just with homes to purchase. It's with rentals, too.
But I don't think the legislator would concern him so much, because then whoever the purchaser is, even if they choose to rent it out, are going to be paying the higher property tax, the reassessed rate. And that's so his concern is revenue to the state. And so that would, from his standpoint, solve the problem. He doesn't care if people rent and make money off a house.
Right. And I just think, though, these families working so long to preserve and leave an inheritance that their inheritors may not even own homes of their own. And just like the last caller, they may not have the opportunity to transition in and move right away. But it's something that's for their future that was left to them. And I think one of the problems we have in California and just America in general is we don't think generationally. We think now. We think fix it now. And these people really took great care to do this for their families. And you know what? If it's excessive, I think that there is a medium ground of saying, you know, an inheritor can only inherit one property, or at having a cap on the value. But, you know, cause there are people who leave bundles of portfolios, you know, to their family.
Yeah.
And so that's a different thing. But I am a realtor, and just like this last caller, we have clients all the time that are just regular run-of-the-mill families. They may inherit a property that still has a small lien, maybe $80,000 or $200,000 left to pay off, or they have to take out a lien to do the improvements, because in old age, these homes get run down because the people who are living in them can't make those big improvements in their limited income as older citizens. So they're not always just getting free and clear and it's just all like bright and rosy. A lot of times they have financial things they have to address. And I, you know, if we were to get rid of this, or just in general, if the property taxes were to go up, even outside of inheritance, I mean, that's going to drastically affect home values too. Every time the interest rates tick up, there's a piece of the population that gets pushed out of the ability to buy. So if those,
property taxes go up, we're going to see the same thing as well.
Renee, appreciate your call. Renee, a realtor in Duarte joining us. We're going to take more listener calls momentarily. Do want to just alert you to the fact Associated Press and multiple other news organizations say that Donald Trump's ex-attorney Michael Cohen will soon be appearing in a New York City federal court, and he will be pleading guilty as part of a plea deal, fraud, the charges, among others, to which he is expected to plead guilty. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Welcome your comments on the AirTalk page as well. You can also tweet at AirTalk. Back in just 1 minute. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're discussing an L.A. Times Enterprise piece about wealthy Californians who inherit family homes, turn around and rent those out for huge amounts of money. And at the same time, the heirs who are doing that are getting the much lower tax basis that their parents had had from years of living in that home. So they're taking the Proposition 13 lower property tax rate. It portably goes to the heir, even if the heir doesn't live in the home. And the Times discloses what the fiscal impact of that is to the state of California. Our question is whether you think that the law should be changed, state as is, or modified in any way. Jeff in Mid-Wilshire District, you're on Air Talk.
Hey, hi. You know, it's funny. I'm sitting here reading the Times article, and it starts off with the Bridges family. I mean, that's an extreme difference than other people. I agree with Richard and Renee. I've worked hard to have my duplex, and I want to pass that on to my children, and they would never be able to afford that property tax and the inheritance tax. It's like the farmers who pass on their farms. And the children have to sell the farms. I've worked hard, and I want my kids to have my property, and that's the one asset that I'm leaving. And if they want to rent it out, they should be able to. And if they had to pay that property tax, that increased property tax, then they would have to have no choice but to jack up the rents tremendously. How is that helping the housing market?
So, Jeff, you use the family farm analogy, but I'm sure there are listeners who would say, well, that's different. That's preservation of a part of American culture. It's not inherited wealth. It's not an inherited tax benefit. So do you see a societal value in being able to pass on obviously the value to your kids, but do you see a societal value in doing that and keeping the lower tax basis?
Well, I think that people work in societal value. That's a tough question to answer. People work hard to own a home. I know I did, and that's the one asset that I have. I'm not a wealthy person. My home is the one asset that I have, and I want to see my children benefit from that.
Jeff, I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. Let me share. Catherine in Santa Ana says, my great aunt just passed away. I inherited a $1 million home I couldn't live in. A lot of these properties are going to end up sold to foreign cash buyers. Sandra in Redondo Beach said, when this law first went into effect, I was living in a wealthy area, watched my neighbors not able to afford to live in property taxes. And I think that it's going to end up creating exclusive communities in certain areas if you do away with the Prop 13 protections. I want to thank our guest, Carl Swedan of the firm Hahn & Hahn. Carl, thank you for coming in, spending this hour with us.
Thank you, Larry. It was a pleasure.
Just switching gears here. Again, we're expecting Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's ex-attorney, to appear in New York federal court shortly to plead guilty on multiple charges as part of a plea agreement. With us is Politico reporter Daniel Lipman. Daniel, thank you for joining us. Can you give us any more details on this?
Yeah, it looks like he's going to plead guilty to charges involving multiple counts of bank and tax fraud and campaign finance violation. And so this was long expected that he would take a plea deal. It's quite the change for someone who said he would take a bullet for Trump.
But it doesn't automatically mean he's cooperating with federal authorities. I think that's a piece that they're still working out. But in terms of his office dealings with the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York, it looks like Cohen is wrapping up this deal.
And campaign finance violations, is this related to Trump's candidacy and the payments, the payment that was made to Stormy Daniels, or do we know what it's related to?
Yeah, I think it's probably related to Stormy Daniels, because, or other women too, who Trump paid off. It's a matter of, you can't spend $100,000+ to pay off a woman during the middle of the campaign when you know, the campaign laws say you can't spend more than a couple thousand dollars. And so this is all coming to roost. And with Manafort's jury in final deliberation, and it looks like he might be found guilty on many of those charges, then that is a serious blow. This is not a great day for President Trump.
We'll see what happens in the Manafort case. We had word earlier that apparently on one of the counts, they're having a difficult time reaching an agreement. Daniel Lipman, Politico reporter with us. Also with us, Jens David Olin, Vice Dean, law professor, Cornell University. He focuses on criminal and international law. Professor Olin, good to have you with us again. What are you reading into the potential plea deal here?
That there's some kind of arrangement to cooperate with the federal government, either against Trump or against someone else who's a business partner of Cohen's. I find it hard to believe that they could reach a plea agreement without some sort of arrangement regarding cooperation against some other potential defendant, because otherwise I don't know why, you know, both sides would have agreed to the deal. In the absence of cooperation, prosecutors would want substantial jail time for these type of charges, and Cohen certainly wouldn't agree to substantial jail time. He would take the case to trial rather than giving it up. So the fact that they reached an agreement and reached an agreement so quickly, I think, signals that he must be cooperating. But the real question is, you know, what does he have to offer and against whom?
Well, and do you think that you'll be able to read much more into it when you know what the sentence is resulting from the plea deal?
I don't think so. I mean, I have to think that the sentence is going to be pretty minor. Otherwise, Cohen wouldn't have agreed to it. So I think that's certain. It's going to be a very minor sentence. I think we'll have to wait to see what kind of case the prosecution builds from this, and whether or not we see an indictment against someone else in Cohen's orbit, like a business partner or someone else who is involved in his financial dealings. If you don't see that, then I think that's an indication that maybe he offered information about Trump. And I think the most likely information would be information about why Trump was so eager to sign deals with Stormy Daniels.
Well, and there were reportedly tapes that were seized as a part of the raid of his office and other locations where Cohen worked. I assume all of that would be heavily scrutinized as a part of this investigation, too?
It would, and his testimony combined with those recordings could be very powerful. So, first of all, you need someone usually to authenticate a recording, and so Cohen can say, I remember that conversation, and what you're hearing in that recording was a true and accurate statement of the conversation. And then he can also say what happened before the conversation and what happened after the conversation was recorded, so he can place the recording in context in a criminal case. So the combination of the recording plus his testimony could be very valuable.
Professor, as always, we really appreciate your expertise. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Vice Dean, Law Professor, Cornell University School of Law, Jens David Olin. Of course, you'll hear continuing coverage of the latest in this, as well as the Manafort court case where the jury continues deliberating. You'll hear it throughout the day here on KPCC. Fresh Air with Terry Gross is next.